Jai. Oh, glories to the assembled devotees. Oh, glories to the assembled devotees. Thank you very much. Oh, glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Oh, glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Mishtai, Murgulaya, Samadhi, Jai Badaka, Swamini, Tanamare, Namacharya Padaya, Nitai, Kripa Padaya, Gorkata, Dham, Nanagara, Kantane. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutle Srimade Bhakti Viranta Swami Tanamare Namaste Saraswati Deva Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisheshunyari Bastade Stane Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Cheva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayet Nasta Prayeshu Fabhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Narayan, unto Nara Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Sarasvati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. By regular attendance in classes on the Bhagavatam and by rendering of service to the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving service unto the personality of Godhead, whose praise with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, fifth canto, called The Creative Impetus, chapter 22, and let's see, I'll just try to finish the chapter today. It's a very technical chapter. It's called The Orbits of the Planets. If there's any class where you want to fall asleep, this would be the one. I don't want to offend the Bhagavatam, but it's a little bit technical. Let's see how it goes. Okay, let me see if I can. Okay. Because Maharaj, he gave lecture yesterday. Let me see. I don't know if you remember that. It was about, what I remember was about the eagles. Hold on. Okay, here we are. And today, let me see. Yeah, we do text number 7, I think. No, I'm a little bit lost here. Is it chapter 22? 22. Really? I'm sorry, I didn't. Are you sure it's 22? Because I'm a little bit lost here now. I didn't prepare it super well. Yeah. Let me just see, because I just had it on my computer, and it's at home. Anybody remember? Because I don't think it's chapter 22, actually.
Yeah, but you should have 21 here.
I know. This is 22.
Oh, okay.
You see?
And then it was 12 opened by Srila Prabhupada.
No, I understand that. But I remember exactly what verse Maharaj did. It was this huge purport.
Okay,
I'll just have to find it out. I mean, I did prepare it. Okay. I did prepare it. It's just that. Let me see. We did this. 20? Maybe it was 21 then. Sorry about this.
Okay.
Can you maybe check there?
It's not mentioned.
It's not mentioned there? Okay. I mean, it's all nectar. I can just read something. But it's nice if we keep the continuation. Let me see. I remember actually that he did text number 8. You know? Anyway, whatever. Haribol, do you remember where we were? You were here yesterday, no? Because I'm just a little bit lost, because there was this huge purport where Maharaj spoke about the eagles that...
Just chapter 22 for sure.
Okay. Okay. Okay, I'll just do text number 12, but it's not chapter 22. Okay, I'll just read something then, I'll just see what happens. Okay. Okay. So I'll just read from Canto 5, chapter 22, text number 12. Translation. Some 1,600,000 miles above this group of stars is the planet Venus, which moved at almost exactly the same pace as the Sun according to swift, slow, and moderate movements. Sometimes Venus moves behind the Sun, sometimes in front of the Sun, and sometimes along with it. Venus nullifies the influence of planets that are obstacles to rainfall. Consequently, its presence causes rainfall, and it is therefore considered very favorable for all living beings within this universe. This has been accepted by learned scholars. Yeah, so here Sukadeva Goswami is continuing to explain to Maharaj Pariksit about the universe, and this is about the planet Venus. Okay, text number 13. Mercury is described to be similar to Venus in that it moves sometimes behind the Sun, sometimes in front of the Sun, and sometimes along with it. It is 1,600,000 miles above Venus, or 7,200,000 miles above Earth. Usually, what I understand when it's, because I'm looking at the Sanskrit. Usually, I explained it a few times that you have a higher planetary system and a lower planetary system, and then middle. And the Earth is situated in the middle planetary system, and it's described as a disk within the universe. So actually, usually when we're talking about this, it's actually that earthly disk generally. Because the Earth actually is a small planet, but these other planets, they're actually like considered heavenly planets. Mercury, which is the sun of the moon, is almost always very auspicious for the inhabitants of the universe. But when it does not move along with the sun, it forebodes cyclones, dust, irregular rainfall, and waterless clouds. In this way, it creates fearful conditions due to inadequate or excessive rainfall. 14. Situated 1,600,000 miles above Mercury, or 8.8 800,000 miles above Earth is the planet Mars. If this planet does not travel in a crooked way, it crosses through each sign of the zodiac in 3 fortnights, and in this way travels through all 12, one after another. It almost always creates unfavorable conditions in respect to rainfall and other influences. Text 15. Situated 1,600,000 miles above Mars, or 10,400,000 miles above Earth, is the planet Jupiter, which travels through one sign of the zodiac within the period of Parivatsara. If its movement is not curved, the planet Jupiter is very favorable to the Brahmanas of the universe. Okay. Then text 16. Situated 1,600,000 miles above Jupiter, or 12 million miles above Earth, is the planet Saturn, which passes through one sign of the zodiac in 30 months and covers the entire zodiac circle in 30 Anuvatsaras. This planet is always very inauspicious for the universal situation. And then the last text of the chapter, text 17. Situated 8,800,000 miles above Saturn, or 20,800,000 miles above Earth, are the 7 saintly sages, who are always thinking of the well-being of the inhabitants of the universe. They circumambulate the supreme abode of Lord Vishnu, known as Dhruvalok, the pole star. Purport. Srila Madhvacharya quotes the following verse from the Brahmanda Puran. Gyanandat mano Vishnu, sishumara vaposhyatya, utva lokeshu savyapta, adityatyas tadashrita. Lord Vishnu, who is the source of knowledge and transcendental bliss, has assumed the form of Shishumar in the 7th heaven, which is situated in the topmost level of the universe. All the other planets, beginning with the sun, exist under the shelter of the Shishumar planetary system. Yeah, so the Shishumar is called, that is actually the pole star. And the way Sariputta explained it is like a Christmas tree. So you have the pole star, and then the whole stars, they revolve around that star. And that star is actually also called Dhruvaloka. And maybe you remember that it's a spiritual planet. So how it works exactly, I don't know, because spiritual means eternal. So that means the planet was already there. And Lord Vishnu also, he resides there. As this doorman, it's described. Anyway, it's a little bit technical. I don't pretend to really understand it, because then different thoughts come up, because this is basically about our solar system. You know, we know these planets, like the so-called Karmis, the scientists, they know about Saturn and Venus. It's all described in scientific literature. So here also is mentioned. You know, I mean, you can just have a quick look at the Sanskrit, but the planets are not so much mentioned. You know, here's Ushanasha, Venus, Buddha, Mercury, and then it says Tataha, from that. You know, of course, it says here Soma Sutta. Soma means the moon, Sutta means the sun, that is Mercury, Buddha, the sun of the moon. So also how these things exactly work, you know, I don't know. We know that the moon has a god or a manager that is managing the moon. The way Sariputta explains it, because it's a little bit of a controversial topic, because, you know, there was this famous or infamous moon landing. And then Prabhupada said, no, they didn't go to the moon. So if they did or did not go to the moon, it's a bit of a controversial topic. There's many people who actually now, because this was in the 60s, and Prabhupada was practically the only person that said they didn't go to the moon. And now there's many persons, actually. You have so many websites, and they tell us that they didn't go to the moon. They have so many proofs. Still, it remains kind of a controversial topic, because, you know, it's not so easy to disprove this. Sariputta also, because ultimately Prabhupada, he left this topic to the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and specifically Sariputta, because he actually worked in NASA. And he kind of indicates also that It's a little bit difficult to prove this, you know. You might end up somewhere where you really don't want to end up. Because if it's not true, then it's of course very, very a big scam. And then that means that governments are involved and you really don't want to kind of disprove that. You want to maybe, but it's like very, it could be very dangerous. So the Buddha kind of indicates it. But there's more than one travel to the moon. I think in total there were like 14. And there's also mentioned that there is like a laser on the moon that scientists, they shoot light to that laser and it shoots back. So, you know, it's not so clear cut as sometimes devotees want to make it to be. Definitely, the way Sariputta explains it is that there is a subtle or higher region. So even if they did some other go to the moon, which I personally believe actually they didn't, because also it's a little bit strange, they shoot up this huge big rocket and then they have this crazy kind of thing that lands there. And then that thing has to come back all the way to the earth. It doesn't make sense to me. There's many more things, but just that thing, it just didn't really make sense. Anyway, so even if that thing somehow landed on the moon, and you could imagine that maybe now they can put some guys there. The way Sariputta explains it is that it's a subtle region. So even you might hit the dust of the moon, the gross planet, but you can't really see the subtle planet of the moon. And that is also how it's, more or less described in the Bhagavatam. You know, there's because in the Bhagavatam also we talk about the lower planets and there's ghosts there. So everybody, not everybody, but many people, they know that there's ghosts, but you can't see them. So you should understand it like that. And so, and it's very difficult to understand it, because if there's a subtle region of the moon, maybe it's bigger. Because there is a book called Surya Siddhanta and they give a little different distances that are given here in the Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada also mentions in the Chaitanya Charitamrita a different number of the size of the universe. Much bigger number. So, you know, Einstein also explained that time and space are relative. And he explained that it can bend also. It's not going straight in the universe. And we kind of know that the higher you go up, the slower time goes. In other words, Lord Brahma gets very, very old. Like if you look, for instance, at the North Pole, it's 6 months light and 6 months dark. So that is one year, and that is one day of the demigods. So the demigods, their one day is our one year. So the higher you go, the slower the time is. So if you... It is sometimes mentioned that one devotee would go to Brahmalok and then he came back and then everything had changed. So the time actually goes slower there. So time and space, they are connected. So we shouldn't take these distances, that is what I understood from Sariputta's book, we shouldn't take them as absolute in the sense of how the scientists sometimes take distances. And you know, even the scientists, it's not so like here on the earth we go from Paris to Amsterdam and it's like, I don't know, 2,000 kilometers or something. It's very clear, you can measure it. But when you go in the universe, there's gravity and things can kind of bend. And I just explained about time. Of course the scientists really don't really accept it, but we more or less know this for a fact. You know, that Brahma gets very, very old, and that I just explained about the demigods and about this. I forgot the exact story, but there was this devotee and went there, and then he came back, and then everything had changed. So we accept this as fact. So if time goes slower, then also this space and the distance, it is also not so absolute as maybe the scientists want us to believe, or so-called scientists. So these are just some thoughts. And then with the moon... Yeah, like I said, it can also be that because in the I remember in the Surya Siddhanta sometimes a different measurement of the moon is given, much much bigger than the scientists give. So maybe that is the subtle body of the moon. How all these things exactly work, I don't know. We're basically like ants trying to understand these things, like an ant cannot understand Radhadesh or Liège. So similar, we are also in like a very small position, like earthlings, mortals that we're called. And then the demigods, they're practically, compared to us, they're like immortals. And these books, this book is written 5,000 years ago. And in those days, those demigods, they would actually visit the earth, like Arjuna's mother, Queen Kunti. She was visited by the sun god and also by Indra and Vayu. These are all very, very big demigods. So in those days, it was normal that there was still kind of traffic between the different planetary systems. And then when Kali Yuga started, it kind of got sealed up. You know, the demigods, they don't really visit this planet, not the way they would visit them in those days. So yeah, we should take these things into consideration. Otherwise, it becomes a little bit like fanaticism. And we can accept the Bhagavatam. It's just that we have to understand sometimes how it is exactly true. Because these, you know, I should have maybe looked it up, but I'm not exactly sure about this distance, 1,600,000 miles, or here it says 7 million miles above the earth. I think it's more. I'm not sure what the scientists say. But if you look at the Surya Siddhanta, then the numbers add up. The Surya Siddhanta is also Shastra. It just gives different numbers than the Bhagavatam. But those numbers that are given in Surya Siddhanta, they match very closely with the so-called scientific numbers. You know, so it's not so, like devotees, they said, yeah, Bhagavatam, we have to accept it. We accept it, but it's explained that these numbers are numbers for yogis and saints and sages. So maybe if you're a yogi, then they travel differently. They can travel on sunlight. It's described like that. They can travel through water. They can travel in many other ways. So maybe for them it's 7.2 miles. That is sometimes how it is explained. Are there any questions on this? Any astrologers that want to make a comment about this orbits of the planets? Because this is also, you know, very descriptive for astrologers. They give some. Sukadev Goswami is giving some. Yes, please. Oh yeah, that is also interesting. Yeah. Let me read it again. The question was, what do the planets have to do with rain? So that was text number 12. I'll just read the whole thing again. It says here, some 1,600,000 miles above this group of stars. And that was described in the previous verse. Is the planet Venus. So Venus, that was also worshipped in the Roman Empire, is also, I think, related to the goddess of love, like that, which moves at almost exactly the same pace as the sun, according to swift, slow, and moderate movements. Sometimes Venus moves behind the sun, sometimes in front of the sun, and sometimes along with it. So it's described, it's a little bit, also very controversial. It's described that actually the sun moves around this disk which is inside the universe. And here's described that Venus moves sort of near the sun. And sometimes it's exactly the same, sometimes a little bit in front, sometimes a little bit behind. How that exactly works, I don't exactly know. Because it also, again, it's not like when you go from Amsterdam to Paris, it's very clear how the movement is. You go from Amsterdam to Paris, it's a linear thing. But with these things, it's kind of relative. Like here we speak about the pole star, and the whole thing kind of moves around the pole star. So sometimes it's not completely clear from which perspective they're speaking. So from which perspective it is moving, because the earth is also moving. Of course, the scientists say that the sun is not moving, but that is according to the earth. According to the earth, it's not moving, but that doesn't mean that maybe the sun is moving. But anyway, it is all, for me, a little bit complicated, but let's just read on. Let's see if we can explain about the rain. Venus nullifies the influence of planets that are obstacles to rainfall. Yeah, so the idea is that the sun travels and then Venus travels behind it, and every planet, the scientists, they also say this, they have a sort of like a gravity, and it has influence on other planets. And of course, the so-called Western scientists, they don't really accept astrology, but many, many people accept astrology, and they know that different planets have different influences. And what I always said when I was younger about astrology, that it must be true to some extent, because you have the moon. And the scientists know that the moon makes the tides. Right? This is common knowledge. Because of the moon, you have high tide and low tide. The oceans move because of the moon, because of how the moon is positioned. So our body consists of 80% of water. So then the moon doesn't have any influence? That doesn't make any sense. And we know it, actually. The police, they know on full moon, there's generally more crime. They know it. They prepare. Full moon, they prepare. So it has influence. There's no doubt about it. And therefore, also other planets, they also have influence, because they also have some gravity. So that is, you know, what has been talking about there. That, and we don't know exact, because it's more subtle, because the scientist is very gross. You know, they just talk about gravity and like that. But we know that there is a god also on Venus, like who manages the planet. And it has a special, like everybody has a special vibration, a special mood. So Venus also has a special mood. And it is a very auspicious mood. It is a higher planet. So here it says that it nullifies the influence of planets that are obstacles to rainfall. So we know from Bhagavad Gita that if you perform yagya, especially Sankirtan yagya, in other words, if you chant Hare Krishna, then rain will come. And that is important. Like, we don't really realize it so much because we are in Belgium and it always rains. So we think, like, it's bad when it rains. That is, I'm from Holland. Like, people, they complain when it rains. Pralanda Maharaj also explains that actually if it rains all the time, especially during the day, it's actually inauspicious. Because the way it's supposed to be is it should be raining at night. And so if you perform Sankirtan Yagya, then the weather will regulate itself. And so Venus also, it has a good influence. So generally, it is actually good when it rains. And so here it is said that this Venus planet, so some planets, according to Sukadeva Goswami, they have a bad influence on the rain. So how that exactly works, I don't know. But you can imagine that if the moon has influence on the oceans, that other planets can also have influence on certain clouds. And how it rains and where it rains. Like, for instance, if all the rain is on the ocean, that is not much use, because it can also rain on the ocean. So this is all very intricate. Like, we can predict the weather, but we can't influence it. They try, but they can't really influence the weather. Like, there's now so many storms in the United States of America. So there's nothing they can do about it. Just destroys, like, hundreds and thousands of homes. So, you know, this is all very, very powerful, these forces. So that is the answer. It is by Venus that there is rainfall. Have you heard about Venus? Yeah. So that is by Venus that there is rainfall. That is the answer. And how it exactly works? Maybe not even Sukadeva Goswami knows. Only Krishna knows. Because Sukadeva Goswami explains, you can't really understand this. Okay, what shall we do? Shall we have a early, shall we just have a quick class? Or shall I go to the next chapter? I think we can just stop here, you know. Are there any other questions? Yeah, actually, I'm just looking now. I can read a little more if you want. It's up to you. We're actually in chapter 23, because I'm seeing now the purport. I just kind of missed it. And I wanted to finish, actually, this chapter. But it doesn't matter. It's all nectar. I mean, I could read a little bit, because I prepared this. Maharaj did this huge purport, and then Sukadev... Should I read that, what we did yesterday? I don't think we have to read that, no? We can just go on, because we're talking about all these different planets, which is basically, it's, I mean, like I said, I don't pretend to understand it, but from a scientific point of view, it's just describing our solar system. It's very clear. It talks about Mercury, Venus, Saturn, all these different planets that we know. So then the next chapter is called the Shishumar planetary system. And it's said that it's shaped like a dolphin. And it's actually interesting, because it says that it's a planetary system. It doesn't even say that it's the whole universe. Like, for instance, I don't know if you know that, but the scientists, they talk about the Milky Way. And in the Bhagavatam it's described that actually the Ganges, that is the Milky Way, or at least the Ganges follows that. And our planetary system is inside that Milky Way. It's actually a tiny speck. Yeah, so that the next chapter, that is describing that Shishumar planetary system. And that is even more technical. The thing is, what Prabhupada mentions in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's a very important chapter. Prabhupada mentions that you should study this chapter with the help of a spiritual master. Anybody remembers what it's called, that chapter? I think it's called The Three Modes of Material Nature. It's a very technical chapter. It explains about the 24 elements and like that. So we need to know where we are. You know, that is why also Sukadeva Goswami is giving these descriptions. Because otherwise you'll be in ignorance. You don't know where you are. So he's describing where we are. He's describing, because, you know, it's Kali Yuga, and we've got all these. I mean, they do have their merit, scientists. Like, they make clocks. You know, they know how to cut marble very nicely. So it does have its merit, like wearing glasses, you know. It's just that they kind of go out to disprove the existence of God. But we do know a lot about these planets. But in those days they didn't. So it's giving a description where we are in the universe. And it's important, actually, to know these things. So I'll just read a little bit further. Okay, here's text number 4. This is actually where we left off yesterday. This great machine, consisting of the stars and planets, resembled the form of a Shishumar, dolphin, in the water. It is sometimes considered an incarnation of Krishna, Vasudev. Great yogis meditate upon Vasudev in this form because it is actually visible. Purport. Transcendentalists, such as yogis whose minds cannot accommodate the form of the Lord, prefer to visualize something very great, such as the Virat Purush. Therefore, some yogis contemplate this imaginary Shishumar to be swimming in the sky the way a dolphin swims in water. They meditate upon it as the Virat Rupa, the gigantic form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I wanted to actually, because there's no more purports in this chapter except for the last text. It's a few more texts. Somebody else can do it, I guess. What I found interesting is that usually we know kind of about the universal form. I just spoke about Bhagavad Gita. It's described there. It seems that this is talking about something different. Like, we learn from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and this is actually something that you have to understand when we discuss this universe. And then I'll try to wrap it up. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teaches us, it is achincha bheda bheda tattva. It is one and inconceivably also different. It's one and different, but it's inconceivable. So the way Sariputta explains these things is that it's layered. Like, I don't know if you know that, but they discovered that, for instance, the pyramids, it's like a blueprint of a star system. Did you know that? You know that? Yeah, so the nobody knows that? You never heard of that? Yeah, the pyramids, they're positioned in such a way that if you look at it from above, and then the Nile also has a function, that it describes a specific star system.
Constellation.
Yeah, constellation. And also the pyramid itself, it is positioned in a specific way. So, and we learn from Bhagavatam that actually the Kshatriyas, they got kicked out by Parashuram and they went to Egypt. This is how Prabhupada described it. So they were also part of the Vedic culture, but they were very much into demigod worship. So my point is that similarly, there's descriptions also of India, you know, and then Sariputta explains it that it's sometimes talking about the earth and about India, sometimes it's talking about the, you know, higher planetary system, and there's different layers. Like I gave the example last time also, like you have a tree, this is called the chaos theory, and like some trees, they're shaped like this, and then if you look at the leaf is also shaped like that. So with that, it's very easy to see, or like when you have a cabbage, you take one leaf and it's the same. But they also say that with cigarette smoke, you also have a fractal, it's called. So it looks like it's chaotic, but there is a fractal. Fractal means like you, like one divided by two. So then two is the fractal. So when you go smaller and smaller and smaller, there is a constant thing there. So it looks like, but there is a constant fractal. So there is. It looks like a chaos, like how the smoke goes, but there is actually a structure inside it. So similarly in the universe, it kind of looks like it's a little bit chaotic, but it's not. So sometimes these things, it's layered, and it speaks about different things. So also this Viradrupa, maybe there's like different Viradrupas, because we have our solar system, it's actually very small. So then maybe there's different systems like that. You know, so this Viradrupa, it talks about these different planetary systems, and that the Viradrupa is kind of that whole, because that is what this chapter is called, the planetary system of Sishumar. Like here, for instance, said, on the upper chin of the Sishumar is Agasti, on his lower chin, Yamaraj. So Yamaraj is the lower planetary systems. On its mouth, Mars. On its genital, Saturn. And they're talking about the universal form. Kind of, Viradrupa. But it's basically about our solar system, which compared to the universe, it's tiny. So you're kind of getting my drift? It's like there's different layers. You see, so it needs to be studied very thoroughly. And it's not so easy to... And if you read Sariputta's book, he's all the time posing questions. Like, we don't understand this. We need to study this more, you know? He also comes up with facts, but... And actually, that's what I wanted to talk about, and then I'll really conclude. We now also have to come up with this planetary blueprint in Mayapur. What is it called? The Temple of Vedic Planetarium. You see, so that is why it's a very big topic. And it's a little bit controversial also, because our acharyas never really commented so much. Even Srila Prabhupada, in one of the previous chapters, he just gives the Sanskrit. Remember that purport? He just gives a purport and he just gives a Sanskrit. Dhanavir Swami, he translated it a few years ago. But Prabhupada didn't bother. He didn't bother translating it, because he could just see this is going a little bit above, you know. Prabhupada just he gave the essence. And none of the acharyas really commented on it. And they kind of left it up to us. You know, unfortunately now Sariputta left his body. So you know, I'm a little bit concerned if they're gonna get it right. But there's many things involved with this, you know, Guru Tattva, you know, because, you know, generally we say the Guru is perfect, and it's true, but like with these things also, we have to understand how the Guru is perfect. You know, because ultimately only Krishna doesn't make any mistakes. Anybody can make a mistake. You know, but it's generally we say the Guru doesn't make a mistake. That's the understanding. But we should try to understand things. We shouldn't become fanatical about it. Because Prabhupada sometimes also, he forgot a verse or something like that. So then you can't go like, oh, he made a mistake, he's not a guru. And we do it also in ISKCON. You know, in ISKCON also. Of course, we did make many, many big mistakes. And then the GBC says, no, you're not a guru anymore. You know, but there's also, you know, like gurus, and they also, sometimes they make a mistake. But that doesn't mean that they're not guru. So we have to understand how these things are, you know. And that is actually a little bit the point of my lecture. That we should really try to understand this philosophy. Prabhupada says many, many times, try to understand. And these things also, they need to be discussed in the mode of goodness. It's very, very difficult. Because devotees, I'm not an exception, they tend to argue. So that will never work. You know? And we need to, especially in Bhagavatam class, I mean, you know, I'm sitting now here on the seat, but we should try to be respectful to the speaker. Sometimes the speaker might say something that is not completely correct, but I personally feel it's better to correct them afterwards. Because otherwise it becomes like a quarrel. We think it's very important, I need to correct them for all the devotees, but it's not always necessary. The point is we just need to try to understand it. You know, and if we see something that somebody, like I might have said something wrong, but it's better to just discuss it in a kind of mode of goodness kind of way. You know, because it's a gradual process. So if somebody is going off track, then we just tell them, you're going off track, I think. You need to a little bit adjust. It doesn't have to go immediately. That's passion, you know. And we're all friends here. We're all kind of equal. It's not that I'm 80 years old and I'm coming from India and I started this whole movement. And I'm not Prabhupada, you know. It's different. We're more or less the same here. Little age difference like that, but... So we have to really treat each other with mutual respect. But the main thing is that I want to say that when we discuss these things, Bhagavatam, not only these technical things, but any, then it has to be discussed in the mode of goodness, and we have to try to understand it. Prabhupada many times said that we're scientists. So, you know, everybody knows that scientists, they do things in the mode of goodness. So we have to try to come to the mode of goodness and to discuss these things in the mode of goodness and to really try to understand it. And ultimately, it doesn't matter. All we need to do is realize, who am I? I'm a servant of Krishna. Who is Krishna? Krishna is God. And how can I please Krishna? How can I serve him nicely? This is what the gopis do. This is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught us, that the gopis, their love, their service is the highest, and we should just follow in their footsteps. That is ultimately what we need to do. But because of preaching, and that is what this Vedic planetarium is about, we sometimes need to become philosophical. But that needs to be done in the mode of goodness. I think it's very important. Also when we preach, you know, we should not let us drag down in arguments on television that are in the mode of passion. We should be careful with that. Okay, I'll stop there. Is there any final comment or question? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it can be revealed from within the heart. Yeah. Of course, it's also said that, like, there's this pastor with Lord Ramachandra, that these sages were there. They were very learned sages, and they wanted to have a relationship with Ramachandra. He said, but I cannot do it because I only have one wife, but you can come back in the next yuga, and then I'll have more wives. And these sages that became gopis, that's how I remembered it. So, and also it is said, what is it? Jesam Twantakata Papam Janiyam Punya Karmanam. That if you become a devotee, actually you've done all the punya already, all the yajnas you've already done. So this is the Siddhanta, it's a conclusion of all the knowledge, is to surrender to Krishna. And the gopis there, sometimes I don't know so many about it, but actually they know quite a lot of Shastra. Ultimately it's not necessary, it's true, but for preaching, you know, and we are a preaching movement. We're supposed to become brahmanas. You know, so, and brahmana means knowledgeable. So, we should actually be all knowledgeable about these things. You know, it's not that we want to force it. You can just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. That's our kind of our commercial. You know, but actually, we want, like Maharaj was saying, that it's good to fast on Ekadasi. The Prabhupada didn't encourage it so much, but it's good to do that. You know? He did encourage it to some extent. You know, so it's good. We should be austere. We should be learned. We should be all these things.
I remember a lecture from Prabhupada. He said, "If you trust me, you chant Hare Krishna, that's it. But if you want really to know everything and you read my books,
so yeah." No, it's true. That's what I'm saying. It's also a little bit of a commercial. Like, chant and be happy, that's it. Prabhupada also said that blind following is condemned. If you don't understand it, but what you're saying, what he's also saying, if you don't understand what, if you don't understand how to surrender to Krishna, how to serve Krishna, that is ultimately what we need to understand. So if that is not clear, then you need to ask questions. It's not that we have to ask 10 million questions about this chapter. I mean, if it's your service, then you can do that, if you have to build a planetarium. But for us as devotees, it's important that we just know, how can I serve Krishna? That is also, we discussed it many times, that's also why I need the guru. Because he can see your character, and he can see, you know, what is better for you. Like, for instance, now I just changed ashram. So, you know, I feel better situated. So you do that in consultation with other devotees, and then they tell you, yeah, maybe it's a good idea, like that. So, you know, there's a whole system in ISKCON, but that's also why I need a guru, so that you can be well situated. And then in that way serve Krishna. You know, but that's ultimately what we need to figure out: how can I serve Krishna in the best possible way? Okay, last one. Last comment.
I was just thinking that the aim of the students that go to Bhaktivedanta College is not to present themselves as some advanced devotees, that because within the college we're advanced. It's more to get a qualification in a conducive environment to nurture ourselves spiritually, as well as equip ourselves with a degree to go into the world outside so we can get some sort of work. At the same time, neglection of education is not written in scripture. It says you should be brahmacharya, you should study the scripture under the authority of a guru up to the age of 25. And so that's what the aim of Bhaktivedanta College is, in a sense, because for 3 years at least you study in-depth scripture that isn't necessarily presented so easily available in Prabhupada's books. Like, it goes more deep into stuff like Vedas, Upanishads and stuff like that. And it's all essential knowledge, really. So, I mean, I don't feel you can neglect the importance of education, because what we're studying, at least in theology degree completely, is our Vedic culture and studying Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami's books. So I don't see how a systematic study of that can be wrong, but nevertheless, yeah, it doesn't mean that we're more advanced or anything than anyone else. But that's also not the aim of the college students. I think that's important to say.
So what's your point exactly? I think I'm getting it.
My point is that months or whatever it is.
Oh, I see.
That's not the aim, and that's not our aim either.
Yeah, well, that's what I was also saying, no? Mm-hmm. That we do need to be austere. We do need to study Prabhupada's books, and like you're saying, you can take it even a little further. Prabhupada did say that we should also study other books, like Mahabharata, Goswami literature, and it's good to have a good knowledge about the Vedas and things like that. It's very good, for sure. Yeah, so we should do that. Like Bhakti Rick is always working hard, but he's also studying, right, Bhakti Rick? Mahabharata. But also Bhagavad Gita, no? Right, so and Jayananda also, he was also always working hard. He would also study Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So we shouldn't just be working, you know. I think we have to close it. I'm sorry. I have the last word. You can come here also next time. I can ask one more. Then you are going to have the last word. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.